Hi, y'all, and welcome back to the Unknown Soldiers podcast. I am your host, James Hauser, and I'm back. After a long hiatus, I have returned. Hope you're ready to go back on campaign. This is technically the start of Season 3, and just like Seasons 1 and 2, we have to kick it off with a visit to the Graveyard of Empires. But this time it's going to be a long visit, because we're starting off Season 3 with a series on the Soviet-Afghan War. The Soviet-Afghan War is one of those conflicts I always plan to talk about. Some of you won't know anything about this war, some of you will know a little bit, or maybe even more. But the Soviet-Afghan War is a very misunderstood conflict. Lots of common knowledge or meme knowledge or pop history knowledge about this war is inaccurate or misconstrued or just flat out wrong. This war needs a lot of context and nuance to really grasp. Well, I'm going to provide that. And some drama. And some gripping descriptions of combat action. And some bad jokes. That being said, this war becomes not funny kind of quickly. Very bleak and nasty. It's one of those wars. One thing I'm getting out of the way right now, this is our third visit to Afghanistan. In two previous episodes, Episode 1, Graveyard of Empires, and Episode 34, Return to the Graveyard of Empires, I talked about the Anglo-Afghan Wars, the British invasions of Afghanistan. And the details of those stories are not really relevant to this one. They are not required listening or re-listening before this series. Anything that's important, I will cover in the series itself. So feel free to go back and listen to those just if you want to get your Afghanistan on. Just don't feel like you need to. So James, why the Soviet-Afghan War? First, this will be the most modern historical event I've ever talked about. The most modern episode I had before this one was the Entebbe raid in 1976, and this war starts in 1979, so I get to talk about air power, tanks, helicopters, the Cold War. It's just nice to get out of the 19th century, man. Another reason, this is a war that holds up a mirror. The obvious comparison with the Soviet-Afghan War is the American War in Afghanistan. Of course, and I will compare the two. But what this really is, functionally, this is the Soviet Union's Vietnam. There's so many parallels between America's war in Vietnam and the USSR's war in Afghanistan, it gets uncanny. But the biggest reason is that the Soviet-Afghan War is one of the most important conflicts of the last century. It has probably had a more direct impact on your life than any other war I've talked about. These events happened when you or your parents were alive. Most of the last episode takes place when I was alive. One question I always try to answer in this podcast is, why you should care? How is this story relevant to you and the world you live in? I am going to use the Soviet-Afghan War as sort of a framing device, as a central plot, to tell two other stories. The first is the collapse of the Soviet Union, one of the watershed moments of modern history, a dividing line where the world before it and the world after it were different. The second story is the rise of an ideology called Islamism, or as we might know it, radical Islam. The Soviet-Afghan War plays a major part in that story, the story of Islamism's emergence as a major geopolitical force in the late 20th, early 21st century. I am going somewhere with this. The main narrative of this series will end in September 2001, and everything after that I consider to be current events. One thing I will stress, we can't see the Islamists as boogeymen. We can't see them as stock villains like they're in some action movie from 2006. We have to see them as people who believed in something, and like many people who strongly believed in something, acted in horrible ways to achieve their ends. We have to look at these people as humans, as complex individuals, not just as cartoon, crazy Islamic terrorist villains. We have to be clear about this. So the main story of this series will be the Soviet-Afghan War, with two important subplots, the fall of the Soviet Union and the rise of radical Islam. In this introduction, what you listen to right now, I'm going to do four things. First, I'm going to give a very basic framework of what this war was and how this series is going to go, what you can expect. Second, I need to get some terminology, some vocabulary, some other housekeeping out of the way. Third, I'm going to touch briefly on my sources. Finally, I'm going to discuss my themes and the big questions for this series. What am I focusing on? What questions am I trying to answer? What's my point here? Why should you care? So if you don't know your Kremlins from your gremlins, great, take a listen. I won't be long. If you want to get to the good stuff, you'll have to wait a week. The Soviet-Afghan War Part 1 will be out a week from now. Until then, though, I have a prologue episode out called Welcome to Afghanistan, which is an in-depth look at the geography, people, and history of this Central Asian country where we are going to be spending the next few months. It's basically a huge chunk of context on Afghanistan that will be super useful for understanding the rest of the series. Are you still here? You want to listen? Cool. Let's get this introduction going. First, when and where does this story take place? The Soviet-Afghan War took place from 1979 to 1989. More specifically, December 24, 1979 to February 15, 1989, when Soviet troops entered and left Afghanistan. The war lasted 9 years and just under 2 months, so most of the 1980s, which is less than half the time the United States war in Afghanistan lasted. But as always, I am extending the narrative. The lead-up to this war begins in 1973, of course. We gotta understand how the war began, and there's a huge amount of context to pack into that lead-up. But the last episode of this series will take place almost entirely after the Soviet withdrawal, after the end of the war. This will include the fall of the Soviet Union, the Afghan Civil War, and the rise of the Taliban. The Soviet-Afghan War's consequences are such an important part of the story that the entire last episode is basically just the epilogue. So we will be spending most of our time in the 1980s, the favorite decade for all things retro. Nintendo and MTV and Michael Jackson and Madonna, bad haircuts and neon colors and Rubik's Cubes, you get the idea. Throughout this series, I'll be listing top 40 hits and number one movies so that you guys realize just how recent this war was. It's an odd juxtaposition. There was a small possibility that a Soviet rifleman standing guard in Kunar province was listening to Def Leppard on his Walkman. However, keep in mind, most of this material culture, the Soviets or the Afghans would have had basically no contact with. Like, none of these guys are listening to Michael Jackson vinyls, like, while they're sitting in their caves in Lagman province. It's not happening. They might, if they're very lucky, they might have a Walkman from the bazaar, but... Okay, moving on. Worldwide, this was an era of massive population growth and economic growth, the age of unrestrained capitalism in America. This was also the era of the late Cold War, the great nuclear superpower rivalry between the United States and the Soviet Union, and their respective allies. The Cold War plays a huge part in the story of the Soviet-Afghan War for obvious reasons. It's a Cold War conflict. This was also a time when nuclear war seemed like it could happen at any moment. There's lots of media from this time period about nuclear weapons and disarmament. Lots of pop songs mention neutron bombs and nuclear apocalypse. Like, movies like Terminator feature atomic bombs going off in some of the scenes. It's more of a... People are just much more aware and conscious about the possibility of nuclear war than they are today, really. Who are the main world leaders during this time period? Well, most of the war, Ronald Reagan is the president of the United States. Jimmy Carter a little bit at the beginning, George W. Bush Sr. a little bit at the tail end. Margaret Thatcher is the British prime minister. Helmut Kohl is the German chancellor. Deng Xiaoping is the premier of China. And, of course, our Soviet leaders. Leonid Brezhnev will be a very major character in part one of our series, followed by a couple of short-lived successors until we get to Mikhail Gorbachev, who will lead the Soviet Union through most of the last half of our series. Okay, that's when this war takes place. But where does this war take place? Afghanistan, mostly. There was some bleed over. There were times when Soviet aircraft strayed accidentally, quote-unquote accidentally, into Iran and Pakistan, and times when the Afghan resistance, actually struck targets inside the Soviet Union. But one of the main features of this war is that what started as an internal Afghan civil war, like Afghan government versus Afghan resistance, became a Cold War conflict. It starts as an internal war, and then other countries start getting drawn in. The Soviets, of course, at first. That's how it became the Soviet-Afghan War. But then lots of other countries got involved in supporting the Afghan resistance against the Soviets. The Saudis, the Pakistanis, the Iranians, the Chinese, the British, the French, and of course the Americans. Anyone who had a bone to pick with the Soviets, and boy, in the 1980s, a lot of people had bones to pick with the Soviets. So this was a local conflict that became a global conflict. And because it became a global conflict, the Soviet-Afghan War had global consequences. That is one of the central themes of the series, basically, that local conflicts can have a global effect, that the internal disputes within a small country that doesn't seem significant at all can affect the course of history just as much as the actions of the great powers. So this was more than just a war that happened in Afghanistan between the Soviets and the Afghans. Okay, so what is this series going to look like? I'm going to be telling the story of the Soviet-Afghan War, the broad plot, in 5 full-length episodes, with some short rounds and supplemental episodes here and there. The supplemental episodes are pretty important. They're more or less me focusing on one aspect or one nuance of this war for a long time, but they're all going to feed back into the main episodes. Okay, so real quick, I'm going to give you a very brief rundown of how this is going to go. I'll say it again. There is a prologue episode on the feed called Welcome to Afghanistan that I think is pretty awesome and recommend you listen to. It's an entire episode full of Chekhov's guns about Afghanistan's history and social context and blah, 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 that are all going to go off during the series. Bunch of Chekhov's guns. I'm setting up a bunch of stuff that's going to come into play. I recommend listening to that. But after that, in the Soviet-Afghan War Part 1, I am going to describe the state of the Soviet Union and Afghanistan before the war, then all the events leading up to the Soviet invasion itself. This episode is longer than usual, just because there is so much context. The episode will culminate in Operation Storm 333, the Soviet takeover of Afghanistan on December 27, 1979. And that will be Soviet-Afghan War Part 1, a special military operation. This will be followed by a short round called Stumbling Bear, the Soviet Armed Forces in Afghanistan, where I will talk about the Soviet military, its soldiers, its weapons, its strengths and weaknesses. Very necessary background for this war. You're going to want to listen to that. So that'll be Soviet-Afghan War Part 1.5. In the Soviet-Afghan War Parts 2, 3, and 4, we are going to talk about the course of the war. And guys, this war is, like many guerrilla wars, there's no big campaigns. There's no big battles to go from this battle to this battle, from this campaign to this campaign. This is a guerrilla war. There's 1,000 small battles. There's like tiny ambushes, combat like skirmishes every day instead of a few big battles. There are some big operations, and I'll go into them. But for the most part, this is a very guerrilla, constant, small fighting conflict. So there'll be a lot of room in these episodes for me to describe how this is what the combat was like, but I'm not going to list every single fight that ever happened. That would be impossible. But we're also going to have some time to do some deep dives into various aspects of this war. Each episode, Part 2, 3, and 4, will focus on one of these aspects. So in Part 2, I'll be talking about major events from 1980 to 1982, but also focusing on the nature of the fighting, the structure of the Afghan resistance, aka the Mujahideen, and the story of a single guerrilla leader named Ahmed Shah Massoud, the legendary Lion of Panjshir, who is as close as this series has to being a protagonist. This will all be in the Soviet-Afghan War Part 2, The Bear and the Lion. In Part 3, I'll be talking about events from 1983 to 1985, with a heavy focus on international assistance to the Mujahideen, especially the role of the United States, the Reagan administration, and the CIA, and a crazy Texas congressman named Charlie Wilson. All this will be in the Soviet-Afghan War Part 3, One Man's Terrorist. In Part 4, I'll be talking about events 1986 to 1988, with a focus on the rise of Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev, but also a very, grim, no-joke section on the nasty aspects of this war. The war crimes, the suffering, the brutalization and trauma that this war inflicted. And finally, an explanation of why and how the Soviets tried to find a way out of Afghanistan. All this will be in the Soviet-Afghan War Part 4, Exit Strategy. In between these episodes, I'll be dropping some more short rounds. First, we're going to take a look at the average Soviet soldier's deployment to Afghanistan, how he got there, what fighting and garrison duty and daily life were like, and what happened when he went home, alive or dead. This will be called A Deployment to Afghanistan. Then we're going to do what is basically a standard for me by now, the Women of the Soviet-Afghan War, a short round. Guys, no girl power vibes in this one. It's gonna be bleak, but it's gonna be important. Finally, we wrapped up the story with Soviet-Afghan War Part 5, where we talk about the fall of the Soviet Union, the Afghan Civil War, the rise of the Taliban, Osama bin Laden, and Al-Qaeda, and the road to 9/11. And wrap up the whole series by talking about this war's legacy in both the Soviet Union and Afghanistan. All this in the Soviet-Afghan War Part 5, The Unlucky Country. And that'll be the series. That's what you have to look forward to over the next few months. Lots of content. And I cannot promise that the main episodes will stay under the 2-hour mark. I would like to promise that, but it's probably not going to happen. All right, so let's get into some housekeeping. Some words I'm going to use a lot or not use very much, and an explanation as to why. First, the name of the war is obvious. The Soviet-Afghan War, or the Soviet War in Afghanistan. But there's sort of a hidden inaccuracy in there. See, the war was really, at its heart, a civil war between the Afghan communist government and a countrywide resistance movement called the Mujahideen. The civil war began before the Soviets arrived and continued after they left. So the Soviets sent their troops into Afghanistan to back up the Afghan communists from 1979 to 1989. But the communists were fighting the resistance before the Soviets arrived, and they continued fighting them after the Soviets left. So it's like there's a two-part fight going on. The Soviets come get involved on one guy's side from a lot of the fight, then they leave and the fight keeps going. This means that one perspective that we cannot neglect is the Afghan communist government's perspective, the Democratic Republic of Afghanistan, or DRA, which had its own army that fought alongside the Soviets. So really, this war is the Soviets and their Afghan allies against other Afghans with outside backing. Soviet-Afghan war doesn't quite encapsulate all that. This is also why when I talk about Afghan combatants, I'm going to refer specifically to DRA soldiers or the Mujahideen. DRA are the Soviet-backed government forces, Democratic Republic of Afghanistan forces. I'm going to use that acronym a lot. DRA, DRA, please just... I don't want to have to keep explaining it every time I do it, so just DRA, that's the Afghan communists. The Mujahideen are the guerrilla resistance. I already know I'm going to get tired of saying that word so much, it's a long word to be repeating over and over, but I will refer specifically to a DRA soldier or a Mujahideen fighter to distinguish between the two Afghan sides. Of course, there were multiple Mujahideen factions. I've got to spend a lot of time in part two talking about these factions. And describing them and keeping them separate throughout this series is going to drive me nuts. There are like 9 or 10 prominent Mujahideen factions. It gets really insane. So I'm going to find shorthand ways to refer to them. I have to. I'm going to simplify some stuff. So if you hear me referring to this group or that group by its leader's name or a partial name or a nickname, I'm sacrificing accuracy for clarity. I can't keep saying... This is Jamiat-e-Islami. Remember, the moderate Tajik faction of the Islamist resistance. No, I'm just going to call them Jamiat. It's got to be done. It's going to be confusing, but it's got to be done. Next, I am going to consistently refer to Soviet troops, the Soviet government, Soviet forces, Soviet tanks, and not Russian. The Soviet Union does not equal Russia. Yes, Russia was the dominant force within the Soviet Union, but there were a bunch of other Soviet republics, including Ukraine, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Georgia, Armenia, Lithuania, you name it. These people were citizens of the Soviet Union, but they were not Russians. So despite it being very common in this time period to refer to the Soviet Union as Russia, to its people as Russians, to talk about what the Russians are up to and the Russian spies, I will refer to them consistently as the Soviets and the Soviet Union. If someone is an ethnic Russian, I will refer to them as a Russian. Finally, when it comes to pronunciations and city names and place names, guys, I am doing my best. I'm on really thin freaking ice here. I don't speak a lick of Russian or Pashto or Dari or Arabic. Please bear with me if I get something wrong. I'm basically unable to pronounce several words consistently, like Kabul. It's either Kabul or Kabul. I've been trying, but I can't keep it consistent. I'm already pretty sure I've referred to Khost, a major city in eastern Afghanistan, as Khost and Khost a couple times. Then there is geography. I'll be referring to a lot of locations and cities and regions and provinces in Afghanistan almost constantly. But luckily for you guys, I will have maps of Afghanistan on my website and on social media for you to peruse. And these are some of the best maps I've ever made for any series. I'm proud of them. I would love for you to look at them. These maps currently include a big terrain slash political map and an ethnicity map. Later maps will show the Soviet invasion and occupation and Mujahideen territory and up close on big events. Guys, it's going to be great. So please take a look at the first few sets of maps. They are up, they are available, and hopefully they get you excited for the series. Next, my books and sources. I'm going to go into these in more detail at the end of the series, but I just want to lay my cards on the table for what you can expect. Now, there is one book that everyone brings up whenever I mention this war. This book is The Bear Went Over the Mountain by Dr. Lester Grau, who is one of the leading experts on the modern Soviet and Russian military. I had the great pleasure of meeting Lester Grau a couple years ago. I picked his brain about the modern Russian army, like a few months before the 2022 invasion of Ukraine. But The Bear Went Over the Mountain is a very limited work. It's good for what it is, but it's limited. The subtitle is Soviet Combat Tactics in Afghanistan, and that is exactly what it is. It's solely about Soviet tactics. It doesn't explain why the war started, Soviet strategy or operations, what the Soviet soldier experienced, what his daily life was like, or even really why the Soviets lost. The tactical details in any war are only ever part of the story. If you learn about Civil War tactics in the abstract, you're not going to learn about the Emancipation Proclamation, which is one of the most important events of the war. So we can't just talk about the tactics. The book is great for what it is, and I used it, but it's far from the only resource that I used. For the war itself, I relied on three main books. The first is Gregory Pfeiffer's The Great Gamble, The Soviet War in Afghanistan. The second is Steve Cole's Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden, from the Soviet invasion of September 10, 2001. Third is Roderick Braithwaite's Afghansi, The Russians in Afghanistan, which to me was the most helpful. These are not the only books I use, but they're the guidepost books, the ones I always flip to when I need a date or a source. Of course, there are plenty of others. I read lots of context works on the Soviet Union, Afghanistan, the Cold War, lots of background books on the Mujahideen, including Olivier Roy's Islam and Resistance in Afghanistan, and Mohammed Kakar's Afghanistan, the Soviet Invasion and the Afghan Response. That was a great book. It's told from the perspective of someone who was in Afghanistan as a professor at the time. Multiple books from the Osprey Publishing Company to give insight into weapons and tactics and equipment. You get the gist. But one book struck me more than any other. This is Zinky Boys, or Boys in Zinc, by Svetlana Alexeyevich. She collected first-hand accounts of the war from Soviet soldiers and civilians, and lots of Soviet women, including the mothers and widows of soldiers. Zinky Boys refers to the zinc coffins that the Soviet government used to mail dead soldiers back to their families. This is one of the best books I have ever read, not just about this war, but war in general. It is also one of the most depressing books I've ever read in my life. I had to put this book down and just stare out the window a few times. I will be using lots of quotes from this book. I recommend it very strongly. If you want to, like, it's an excellent read. It's an excellent read. Also, it's just going to devastate you. It's a tough read, but sometimes those are important. Just letting you know, guys, this is a dark, nasty war. I think my next series is going to have to be something a little lighter. Doing this after Paraguay, man, some of the stuff I read for this series was upsetting. I was upset. Anyway, so those are my main sources. Let's wrap this introduction up by talking about some of my focuses in this series. In the course of this series, there are six big historical questions I'm trying to answer for you guys. Our FAQ about the Soviet-Afghan War. I'm going to tell you what happened, but these are like the truths. These are the why, what, when I'm trying to answer. Mostly why. Number one, why did the war begin? Why did the Soviets invade Afghanistan? Straightforward. Number two, why did the Soviets lose? Up front, they lost. Many Soviets and Russians to this day will argue about their kill-death ratios, or how they won all the battles, or how they never lost a major base, or so on and so forth, which are all the same excuses Americans used for Vietnam. But at the end of the day, the Soviets withdrew from Afghanistan like the British before them and the Americans after them without having accomplished what they set out to do. It's an L. So why did the Soviets lose? Number three, what was the role of outside powers, including the USA, in this war? Kind of a vague question, right? It's like more like an essay question. But this is the one that gets a lot of play on like social media and in pop history. Did the United States fund the Taliban? No. No, they did not. The United States did not fund the Taliban. That did not happen. Did they fund Osama bin Laden? A little. But he wasn't Osama bin Laden, the evil terrorist, then. He was Osama bin Laden, the Saudi philanthropist. This also feeds into another mistake, though. Believing that the Mujahideen and the Taliban are the same thing. They're not. We'll go into great detail about that. Many of the people who made up the Mujahideen ended up fighting against the Taliban in the 1990s. In fact, the Americans weren't even the most important outside power in this war. I'll say this again. I'll say this clearly. The Americans were not the most important third party in this war. There was one country that played an enormous role in the Soviet-Afghan war that wasn't the Soviet Union or Afghanistan. One country with a long-term agenda of its own and a plan and a strategy, and they were kind of the only winner in this whole thing. I'm talking, of course, about Pakistan. Moving on. Number four, what was the impact of the war on Afghanistan? Or a better way of asking this, to what degree is the Afghanistan we see in the news today a product of this war, or a product of its own failures, or just the way it's always been? I will argue, cards on the table, that modern Afghanistan is largely a product of the Soviet-Afghan War and what it unleashed. Before the Soviet invasion, Afghanistan was one of the most peaceful, out-of-the-way, calm, relatively unwarlike countries on Earth. That all changes with our story. The Soviet-Afghan War produces the Afghanistan that we see in the headlines today. Number five, why did the Soviet Union fall? Speaks for itself. Did the Soviet Union fall as a result of the Soviet-Afghan War or some other reason? Finally, last question. What is the actual link between the Soviet-Afghan War and 9/11? Well, if the Americans funding the Afghan resistance didn't directly cause 9/11, what did? Well, that will be basically the end of our story, where the narrative moves from the end of the Soviet-Afghan War to one of the defining events of the 21st century. I will say this up front. There is not a direct line from America funds the Afghan resistance to 9/11. There is a connection, but only in the sense that, like, this event happened, 20 other events happened, and then this event happened. It's like saying the killing of Archduke Franz Ferdinand caused D-Day. Yeah, I guess, but the direct connection isn't there. There's too much in between that for it to be a direct connection. Okay, so those are the big questions I'll be trying to answer. But what about our themes? What are going to be the big things I focus on as a historian, as someone who's looking at human behavior and human events and how these things shape history? What am I going to be looking at and focusing on? First big thing is the role of ideology in human behavior. We'll be dealing with two major ideologies in this series, socialism, or more specifically, the official Soviet form of socialism, aka Marxism-Leninism, and Islamism, an ideological, politicized interpretation of the Islamic religion. Both these ideologies were modern, radical, and revolutionary. Both of them had prophets and holy texts. Both used violence to achieve their ends. Both of them wanted to overthrow the world order and create a new order built on their philosophies. And both of them believed in a vision of the future where humanity could be perfected, where the world could be transformed into a perfect society, where history would reach an end point and all the nations would march into a new utopia. The result would be something like heaven on earth. And the important thing about these ideologies is that people really believed them. We're so cynical these days that it's easy to doubt the power of unironic, unambiguous belief. But so much of what the socialists and communists and the Islamists do in the Soviet-Afghan War doesn't make any sense unless they really believed what they said. They really believed that once they gained power and won the struggle and had the opportunity to set the world right, that it would be heaven on earth. They really believed they were doing this for the good of the regular Afghan people, even as they slaughtered thousands and thousands of those people who stood in their way. So ideology explains a lot of why individuals and factions on both sides of this conflict behave the way they do. Their beliefs, their worldview, shapes and transforms the way they see the world, the decisions they make, the policies they adopt. And especially in the Soviet case, the socialist ideology is so all-encompassing that it seeps directly into its military and political policies in Afghanistan. Another theme of this series is incompetence. This isn't our normal incompetence. Guys, we love to rag on our bad and stupid generals over here at the Unknown Soldiers podcast. What we'll be talking about here is deep systemic incompetence at the institutional level. That's why every single episode will have some kind of subtitle. X institution is bad at its job. Star in such genius-laden organizations as the KGB, the CIA, the Soviet Army, the US State Department, what have you. Institutional incompetence is a whole different ballgame from a bad general or an idiot leader. It's deep, systemic, the problems of groupthink and institutional inertia and inflexible thinking. Lots of the individuals in these organizations are smart, well-educated, insightful, sometimes brilliant people. In a relatively rare exception for this podcast, I don't think any of the Soviet generals in Afghanistan were really incompetent. You read about these guys, they're all pretty capable leaders. They even know how screwed up the whole war is, but they could not fix the problems in the Soviet army or the Soviet strategy. No one could. The problem went much deeper than any one individual. Institutional incompetence is, of course, a major feature of the Soviet Union and its downfall. But America's got its own issues. If there is any organization in American history that has routinely failed to deliver on its most basic promises and failed to do its most basic job throughout its existence, it is the CIA. We'll get to those guys in part three. Another major theme has to do with nationalism. Yeah, okay, James. More about nationalism. Haven't we heard enough from you about nationalism? Uno reverse card. We're going to learn about what happens when you don't have any nationalism. As you may already know, Afghanistan is a state. It's a country. It's an entity, but it's not a nation. It is not a unified country with a sense of its identity the same way many other countries are, like, say, the USA, France, China, Korea, even the Soviet Union. Afghanistan is a country where tribal, ethnic, regional, and family loyalties matter much more than national or country loyalties. And for most of human history worldwide, these kind of connections were much more important than national ones. The modern nation-state is a very new invention. The idea that you're supposed to identify with some larger national entity is people think this is super old. It's extremely new, especially on the level of the average person. Throughout the Soviet-Afghan War series, we will continually see Afghans failing to get along or work together and breaking out into conflict over minor differences, even when they're on the same side. This is true both of the Afghan communist movement and the Mujahideen. This lack of unity is one of the major reasons why Afghanistan is the way it is today. We've talked so much in this podcast about nationalism as a unifying force. Well, in the Soviet-Afghan War, we'll see what happens in the absence of nationalism, when every ethnic group and tribe and faction is out for each other's blood with nothing to draw them together. In fact, there might be some nationalism going on, but it's the nationalism of each individual ethnic group trying to take control of the country. Nothing draws these people together. Well, almost nothing. The only really unifying force in Afghanistan is Islam, which will have its own consequences. Next theme, the importance of small powers in a great power game. Histories of the Cold War focus on the United States and the Soviet Union, the policies and leaders and strategies of these two countries. And there tends to be a knee-jerk tendency to assume that only the great powers, only the big important countries, have any say in the course of events. If anything happens in one of those smaller countries, it's obviously something engineered or puppeted by the bigger countries. But time and time again, we see smaller countries, weaker countries, exerting a lot of power on the course of events, and not just because of things that are done to them, but things that they do. The Soviet Union and the United States are, of course, major powerful actors in this story, but so are Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, China, Iran, and all the factions in Afghanistan. And lots of times the great powers are reacting to what these smaller powers do, dancing to their tune rather than the other way around. Sometimes they need the smaller countries just as much as the smaller countries need them. Look at the dynamic between, coming up, the Soviets and the Afghan communists, or the Americans and the Pakistanis, and tell me that small powers can't wield influence in global politics. Even individual factions within Afghanistan will shift the entire phase of the Cold War between the US and the Soviet Union. The small powers matter. They have autonomy and influence and agendas of their own. Something to keep in mind when we look at the modern world. Again, keep an eye on Pakistan. Our darkest theme has to do with something I call brutalization, a concept I'm applying from historian Omer Bartov's work on the German army in World War II. The Soviet-Afghan War was a savage conflict, one that inflicted enormous damage on those that fought it, and especially on the civilian population. In part 4 of this series, we're going to talk about how cycles of violence affect the human psyche, as human beings are stripped of dignity, exposed to cruelty and destruction and killing, until it becomes normalized. They become callous, hardened, numb, their principles and morals erode. They become brutalized. The Soviet-Afghan wars, bombings and massacres and war crimes and rapes, and both sides' casual disregard for human life have a brutalizing effect on both perpetrator and victim. And today's victim is quite likely to become tomorrow's perpetrator. And when the war is over, what kind of people do the brutalized become? How do they fit back into society? And perhaps most tragically, for those who are brutalized as children, what kind of adults do they grow up to be? Finally, in the footnotes episode at the very end of this series, we will examine Afghanistan's reputation as the graveyard of empires. We will compare Afghanistan to other guerrilla wars, like the French War in Algeria, the American War in Vietnam, and the American War in Iraq. And we'll, of course, look at the three modern empires that have invaded Afghanistan, the British, the Soviets, and the Americans, and compare their conflicts. All of them lost, of course, but they didn't all lose in the same way. And final question, big question, could they have won? Could they have won their wars, any of these powers? Could they have conquered Afghanistan? I argue yes. Yes, they could have. Victory was absolutely possible for all three of these countries. But why didn't they win? Well, I guess you'll have to find out. And guys, I think that's about all I have. The series is about to commence. Once again, Welcome to Afghanistan is already on the feed. Feel free to check that out to get a good old heap of context on the setting for our story. And next week, same time, same place, the Soviet-Afghan War Part 1 will be released. Hope to see you guys then. Load your AK, take a swig of vodka, step into your Makba sneakers, and prepare to follow me back into the graveyard of empires. Welcome to Unknown Soldiers Podcast, Season 3.